Where did we stop? 6:59, I think, did we not? Another real important, say, as I said, now we've covered the basic argument, now we're looking at ramifications of what we've been talking about. So 6:60 is a important sentence as far as ramification goes. Because the image of God, Imago Dei, pervades the whole human sphere and makes mankind its voluntary exponent. That's the loaded phrase. Makes mankind its voluntary exponent. It is just possible that the 400-year-old schism in the church and the present division of the political world into two hostile camps are both expressions of the unrecognized polarity of the dominant archetype. Remember, Jung, in contrast to Freud, who put sex at the top, Adler of power at the top, object relations, relatedness at the top, self-psychology, self-esteem at the top, Jung puts the drive of the self as the most powerful drive in the personality. And we've seen that it's very often unconscious. We are unaware of this polarity within us. When that happens, we live out that polarity unconsciously. And that's what's behind the mess of our times. We are in national politics. You know, if you follow the invasions in Afghanistan, I remember reading that they found fleeing Al-Qaeda's diaries where some of the Al-Qaeda had recorded their dreams. And in the dreams they recorded, Allah was speaking to them, telling them to destroy America. You had George Bush and Tony Blair both saying they knew God wanted us in Iraq. So that's a prime example that there is a conflict within the God image that has spread itself out between cultures, not just individuals, and that's what we are living out. On an individual scale, all those dimensions of the self which we don't acknowledge, which have been called taboo in the Christian frame, you know, sex, power, greed, lust, that's all bad. That's in fact what has seized us and is living it out. That's not an instinctual issue, that's a self issue for you. So that we are being driven by this entity that Jung is asking us to turn back to and become conscious of and begin to synthesize and then hear the creative meaning of. Edinger, let me see what he says there. Page 81. The study guide.
Before you go on,
yeah.
Are you saying what you said earlier, that in the evolution of things, then we are at a different level because we should, when you said when you first go into analysis, you take the dreams for what they are usually. Then as you go on, mm-hmm. you have to really question mm-hmm. the dream is what study is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that would be. Collectively, that would be another level that we have come to,
you know,
as humanity.
Yeah. Well, suppose the Al-Qaeda had said, Allah, violence isn't part of Islam.
Right.
Okay. Suppose George and Tony had said, isn't killing wrong?
Thou shalt not kill.
So yes, I think you see they are examples of people contained by the myth, and to contain a myth is take that experience and say what's it mean. It's a perfect example, and so to the extent that we are driven by these factions and these rages, we are being driven by the self.
On that point, how is this different? Because you what you're saying now basically is almost like two aspects of divinity are fighting with itself and getting man to act it out.
Exactly what I'm saying.
Now, in the Job myth, it's divinity that's acting on Job, whereas now it's like, this is more almost like the Trojan War, in which two parts of, get the Greeks to fight with the Trojans. So what parts of God are fighting with itself and pulling us into it?
Now?
Yeah. Because that's slightly different than the Job.
I think it's exactly the same.
Well, Job's not caught between two different parts of God.
Well, between Yahweh and Satan he is.
But there's not two people. In other words, right now we've got, it's like God is fighting two people to fight with one another.
Yeah, that's how far it goes. In other words, he's simply taking that Job pattern and applying it to world history.
So what is the conflict at the divine level, at the self level that's trying to...
Oh boy, that's a big one. I don't think we can get into that today.
You don't have any sense?
Oh, I do have a sense, but I don't want to get off on it.
Okay, Jung doesn't talk about that?
Jung doesn't because the conflict hasn't happened yet. It's the conflict between spirit and matter. Just repeating, now Edinger puts it very matter-of-factly. It's about a page. The basic axiom here is that the image of God pervades the whole human sphere and makes mankind its voluntary exponent. I prefer a slightly different translation of that sentence, which hinges on how you translate a particular verb. The image of God pervades the whole human sphere and is involuntarily represented by mankind. See, so we are the our behaviors are the representation of the split within the God image.
Involuntarily
represented by mankind. I hope you realize what this sentence implies. I want to say a bit about what I think it implies.
Sorry, what page?
81. Mm-hmm. I'm skipping a bit here for the sake of time. The God image, therefore, as the core archetype of the collective unconscious, is the central agent and creative authority which determines the functioning of all individuals and all organic groupings of individuals. He goes from the individual to the society. and by organic groupings, I mean all families, tribes, factions, parties, religions, nations. All groupings, small or large, which are unified by mutual identification with an origin, a cause, or a creed. These origins, causes, and creeds will be expressions of the God image, which is the operative central agent in the psyche of that particular group. What that means, then, is that in all conflicts between nations, creeds, different factions of all kinds, each side will be acting out a commitment to its own version of the God image. In other words, the conflict between any two factions is a conflict within the God image itself. I hope you all follow that. If not, we'll go over it further in the discussion period. But this is my effort to elaborate what is condensed in this one sentence. The image of God pervades the whole human sphere and is involuntarily represented by mankind. As that becomes visible to you, it changes your whole understanding of the functioning of the collective psyche of humanity, of the way it manifests itself politically and religiously and factionally in all its various aspects.
I got the best.
Yeah.
Because they say all, which is a fairly encompassing word, and about a sixth of humans are atheistic. They have not an external God. You know, I think they do experience, and I'm one of them, the human condition of dealing with an ego and a self, but that seems intrinsic to being a human being. It's not a God or a collective God for those people. But my question is kind of twofold. what is that like for the non-Incubus, and how do they fit into that? If that is the collective scheme.
Well, it has nothing to do with what you say. That's the problem. You may say you are an atheist, but the question is, where is the God image in you moving you to behave? How is it moving you to behave? I think that's what he's driving at. The self,
sure.
Another word for God image. He's just wanting us to step back. You know, we dissect behavior in terms of mother influence, father influence. What he wants us to say is, there's something much bigger than that going on. We are driven by this central image, which is an a priori, and each person's got a little piece of it, or each group's got a little piece of it, and that's why we're fighting. And we won't stop fighting until we each begin synthesizing that God image into the larger whole and not a fragmented piece which we're acting out. I think that's the main point. We're each acting out fragmented pieces of a whole we haven't bothered to try to understand. Sandy? No.
And because we live in a world in which the God image, the strongest God image, is one of monotheism that supposes that there's only one God and one to look at it, each one of these little fragments tries to
it thinks it's the king.
If we lived in a pantheistic world, I think we could probably get along much better. But it's the current God image of there's only one, mm-hmm. that then all of these only ones are fighting with one.
There's only one, and mine's right.
But it didn't work before in the pantheistic thing, so why would it not?
Well, it's not so much that it didn't work before, but you think the movement of history is a shift. I mean, you suggest this in the past, that you only said it had to happen where it had to go to a monotheistic, kind of come together from the barbarism of the so-called barbarism of the... Hey, well, this is a quote, broadly quoting, you know.
Yeah.
To get from the barbarism...
The ego couldn't stabilize in a polytheistic society.
And so we, in a sense, had to, according to those reasons, go into a monotheism. And now, picking up a chance that perhaps we're heading into a minute where that has become too rigid.
Yeah, we're so stable that everything that's unstable is going to blow us to pieces.
But also, you said that each little group has got a piece of God.
Yeah.
Well, that kind of worked when there was enough distance between, but we've now become literally so much that we're rubbing up against, and there's no distance between them, and so now they're my little piece has to fight with your little piece because they're right next door to one another.
But Nancy said we're being... or some Carol said, we're moving into a world community. We can't afford not to get along.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got a wonderful little cartoon of two kids on either side of a road, two groups of kids, and both kids are standing behind snowball piles. And one kid said, we got 872 snowballs to your 914, I hope to God we don't have to use them. Okay, we're winding down here. 8691.
Where did you go to?
691. 692. I'll read you a sentence. The first sentence in sending the paraclete. Now Jung is doing sort of what he considers the religious life should be. The sending the paraclete, that's the Holy Spirit, which remains after Christ ascends. The sending the paraclete has still another aspect. This Spirit of truth and wisdom is the Holy Ghost by whom Christ was begotten. He is the Spirit of physical and spiritual procreation. Skip a little bit. Since he is the third person of the deity, this is as much to say that God will be begotten in creaturely man. This implies a tremendous change in man's status. Skip over to 693. future indwelling of the Holy Ghost in man amounts to a continuing incarnation. That's a big phrase in Jung's later work, continuing incarnation. Well, this is what we'll pick up to in the very last one of these in the fall, of Christ as the begotten Son of God and the pre-existent mediator. It's a firstborn in a divine paradigm which will be followed by further incarnations of the Holy Ghost, blah, blah. Skip them. Well, that's it for the moment. Just basically, Jung is saying, again, his version of what it means to go from being contained to being a container. That we see our job not of worshiping God, but of listening to what the self is asking of us and putting that into the world. Facing the split in the self, working to heal it, and then putting its request into the world. That will be, as far as Jung's concerned, a new form of worship. You see how much more responsibility it puts on the individual, and the danger he realizes in the middle of that paragraph, but the closer this bond becomes, the closer it becomes the danger of a collision with evil. Because you are no longer protected by evil, by dogma, but you are living exactly next to your experience, and that experience can be good or bad. We'll spend a lot more time on this. I just wanted to allude to it. He brings it up here, and we'll talk about this in the fall. I think that's enough. I think that's all I'm going to talk about in the book, unless you have any particular questions. We'll spend the rest of the time working on a dream. There's a lot more to say, but it's heavy stuff, and I think that's enough for one sitting. You got the basic idea. Collision with evil, not succumbing, holding to your integrity, the unconscious becomes creative, a line of development ensues, a new image of the self appears, a new center of gravity is formed, and a new life direction is shaped. That because the evil is faced in a particular way. Again, a third model for the self in the context of the large overarching concepts we're working with here. Yeah. Well, the book then now winds to a close with reflections on the state of theology. And 19, I don't remember the year, 51.
November 1950,
the Pope declared that Mary was taken up into heaven bodily. Body and soul in heaven. Well, remember that we saw after the book of Job, Sophia appeared in Proverbs. The idea there was a collision with evil had happened and the feminine was engendered, indicating a step in the transformation of the self. So by analogy, Jung says, I think that's what's going on when Mary gets ascended into heaven. The feminine element predominates again because we are in a period where the God image is going to change collectively. As it was for a personal change with Job, Jung sees in the ascension of the Virgin into heaven an indication in the myth, from the mythological mind, that a change in the God image is in process. The other point he gets into, along the same vein, is at the end of the book of Revelation, you remember everything goes to hell, all this smoke and fire, and at the end of the book of Revelation, there's a pregnant woman described. She's got, I think, her feet on the moon, I think, is that right? Her feet on the moon, and she's wearing a cloak of the sun. So you see, it's a mixture of opposites. And she's pregnant. And the observation, I don't think this is unstandard theology. That can't be Christ, because Christ just had come. It's the Revelation is the second coming. But there's this pregnant woman that ends the book, and her child is in danger of being eaten by a dragon. So when the child is born, the child is taken up into heaven. And Jung's interpretation of that is much like what we just said about the assumption of the virgin. That pregnancy, now psychologically speaking, means that we, even within the Christian psyche itself, there was a knowledge that there would be another change. But the change wasn't ready to happen then, now this is Jung's interpretation, because the ego wasn't strong enough. But we might now very well be living in that period of change, where that child that was taken up into heaven, meaning reserved for a future time, is to be brought down to earth. So Jung sees both of those images, the child being taken up to heaven then, and now the virgin being taken up bodily into heaven, to indicate we are at the time of a psychological and cultural transition away from a previous understanding of Christianity to a new one. He discusses that to sort of bolster his argument about the nature of our historical moment.
And that fits with your point about the spirit. And it's this much,
yes.
Taken up bodily.
Yeah.
It, you know, it's not the idea of
exactly.
It, it's the physicality
it's
of it,
physical, right.
Which is what Sophia is, because Sophia was supposedly fell into matter and got
yeah.
trapped there.
Right.
And that was seen as a negative thing, but it's kind of like now we're beginning to see what you've talked about in the past, the wisdom of
yeah.
the physical.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
What, when was that book written? Revelation.
The book of Revelation, when was it written? I don't know. I think he says somewhere in here, but I don't remember offhand.
300, 400 AD.
A little earlier, I think.
Who wrote it?
John.
John.
Let me see if he says it here, Greg. Yeah. Remember, he's imprisoned? Well, the question is whether he wrote it or whether it was ascribed to him. I
that's what I was trying to say. Probably less than 180.
Yeah, early on. Somewhere in here he says, but I don't know, like, put the thing on it quickly.
Does that sound like early on?
Definitely. Definitely. Well, let's go back to Victor the Russian. I see an ancient throne in a dimly lighted but large hallway. Throne. What's that about? Who sits on thrones? Kings. Kings are the dominant structure. So you see, we're right there at Saul. When you hear these dreams out of context, they don't make sense, but when you spend some time looking at the imagery that make up the issue, then hopefully the pieces will start falling in place. So see, it's an ancient throne. This king has been around for a while. On the throne sits one who looks rugged and powerful, whose name, I think, is Victor. What do you make of Victor? Exactly. What is the psychology of victors? Power. See, the prevailing image of God is power, not love. This is what is in fact moving us. So if you ever wonder why a Christian society has produced so many wars and such greed, it's because the effective value system is power.
Isn't there an interesting, you know,
Oh, is there really?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I didn't know that. Like the theater in London. No wonder I like the theater.
So God is all powerful, but then
no, it's not all powerful. That God's values are about power.
But they pretend he's not there.
But the official version is God is love. The real version is God is power. When I first see him, I say to him, "You are the Russian." He gives me a laugh, which conveys the impression that I have simply stated the obvious. I now learn that in order to survive down through the centuries, he has been around for 2,000 years. Why 2,000 years? Yeah, that's the time of the Judeo-Christian God image. So you see, he is an image of God. About every 100 years or so, he has had to find a new reincarnation. This is accomplished by someone who Victor selects drinking a potion which Victor gives him. This person then becomes the new Victor the Russian. How does evil work? How does evil keep propagating itself? By visiting itself on somebody else, so that that somebody else, generally a young child, will carry it forward. So see, this is an image of child abuse. And there is a drive on the part of the God image that this keeps repeating itself. Otherwise, it will die. It's a pretty horrible picture. But it's what is really moving history. I don't know. I always hate to critique another religion, but I have said to myself, you know, how Buddhism was about as effective as keeping Japan out of war as Christianity was keeping us out of war. So I'm afraid we have to see that this applies not only to our civilization but others. But I really don't like criticizing other religions because I don't understand them. Well, yeah, but I think somewhere, as much as I am enamored of that religion, it's got the same shadow problem we do.
So when the ego is too small, it can always be absorbed. And that's what you're talking about, you know, the human collective ego up until now has not been large enough to stand up against this larger thing. So it, you know, so it doesn't really matter. You know, the religion was an attempt to help the ego grow, but it's taken all of these years for it to get large enough to be actually able to stand and say something wrong.
You know, your point's well taken, but I think there's something else we need to consider, that this irony that the religion idealizes goodness, but in fact, the society that it ordains is committed to evil. And I don't know if it's just a matter of ego or not. I don't think so.
Well, I mean, my sense is when the ego is too small, there's too much power outside of it that can't be regulated, and so that always leads to evil.
Okay. Well, what I wanted you to see how perpetrators are driven to reproduce evil. Because evil wants to continue itself. But now we'll see what's the dreamer's relationship. This is where I think it gets interesting. But in any case, I wanted to give you a image of a 2,000-year-old king who's evil. that's the other side of the image of God that we don't want to acknowledge. And it's still working in behavior. And again, it doesn't make logical sense, but the dream is saying when a child is abused, the Victor the Russian is simply saying to it that evil is passed on. Now, let's see what we can do about it. A friend of mine, who I am unable to identify, takes the potion from Victor's hand and tries to give it to me to drink. I refuse it. He tries to force it on me, but I back away, saying I'll never drink it. Some of the potion spills out, and Victor takes the chalice back. What's going on when someone unknown to the dreamer gives the dreamer Victor's poison? Yeah. But I think here this guy is an inner figure of the dreamers. So that, see, the shadow of the dreamer takes the experience. In other words, the dreamer is receiving the evil, and this person was beaten as a child. The shadow of the dreamer takes the experience from an unknown part of himself. He says, a friend of mine who I'm unable to identify. So he doesn't know this part of himself.
Doesn't Jung say that you fall into the collective shadow through your personal shadow?
And what personal shadow does he fall in with?
So you fall into the power shadow through your personal shadow.
We're not really told here. I think this is an image of feeling guilty for having been victimized. I guessed. Let's see if that plays out. I don't think it fits with the dream.
In the sense that the unknown agent of the self has offered you this toxin, and you're unaware that a part of you has received this.
Yeah, that is true. That's well said. I just wanted to try to qualify what is the nature of that unawareness.
Would it be that in him which feels he deserves it somehow?
That's what I think.
Yeah.
That's what I think, yeah. So, again, you see, what I love about the dreams, and I don't know this for sure, but I think it's a good bet. We would say, well, I'm taking responsibility for what happened to me. The dream says, no, you are having a reaction to this experience which is unconscious. You really don't know the nature of your relation to this experience. That's the beauty of a dream. Now, we'll try to fine-tune that, but I'm just trying to go step by step. I refuse. So he doesn't accept this unknown relationship to the experience. He tries to fight it. Well, it's not exactly Job, because see, Job knew it was coming from Satan and Yahweh. There's this buffer thing going on. And the buffer thing tries to get him to accept it, but then he fights it. So you see, there hasn't been a direct collision between the ego and evil in the dream. There's this intermediary. I guessed what it was. I think I'm right, but I couldn't swear to it. But hold those thoughts, because I think the latter part of the dream will shed some light on that. So he's given the drink, not by Victor, but by this unknown friend. He tries to force it on me, but I back away saying, I'll never drink it. Some of the potion spills out, and Victor takes the chalice back, saying that it doesn't work anyway. He then drinks it himself. Then the few people there turn to look at me and shrink back. The transition has taken place anyway, in spite of my refusal of the chalice, and my features are apparently turning into those of the Russian. So the Russian offers the poison. The shadow takes it, tries to give it to the dreamer. The dreamer refuses. Victor drinks it. The dreamer turns into Victor the Russian anyway. What should have happened?
It kind of reminds me of the Shulamite cup of filth, and that there is something good in there.
No, it's not the same.
No?
You mean the Whore of Babylon.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
No, it's much different. Well, in a way, you've hinted at it.
Well, it sounds like to me that the dream is saying that you have become Victor, and through this process of the shadow acceptance of the toxin, even though you think you haven't, you have.
So how do we keep this guy from becoming Victor the Russian, is my question.
Well, then,
he can't
be all...
Oh, yes, he can. He need to accept the poison directly and not drink it. You see, there is not this collision between the ego and the poison, between the ego and Victor. And I think what it would mean to accept the poison from Victor directly would be to say, yes, I have been victimized, and no, I am not responsible. As it is, the collision between evil and the ego does not occur consciously. So I don't know whether he's accepting blame for it or whether he's denying that anything happened. Something of those two requirements goes wrong when that shadow interferes. Yeah. Either he's denied it's happened, or he's accepted that it's happened and he's blaming himself. And what I think is so powerful about the dream, it shows you how when you are the victim of evil and you don't respond the right way, you become the evil that perpetrates it to the next generation. That's what the dream was trying to warn him about. So my features are turning into Victor the Russian. I'm so angry that I begin beating on my friend, who falls to the floor and is powerless to defend himself. He screams as with both hands I pummel his body in my rage. The others do not dare to restrain me, but do try to aid my friend. There's a doctor there who, between my blows, tries to administer an anesthetic to him. The dreamer was in therapy with a therapist we don't know at the time. I think it was false sympathy. And that's where the therapy ran aground. I cease hitting him and within myself try to think of how the awful power in me could be held in check. I come up with the idea that if the threat of an atomic bomb were held over my head, I would be stopped. The thought itself makes it seem that such is the case, that such an A-bomb is in readiness. See how explosive he is about ready to become. And I begin to accept the fact that I must now bear the consequence of being this victim of Russian. I tie a kind of veil or turban around my head and arise reluctantly to begin my new life. I arise reluctantly to begin my new life. What I wanted you to see how that, first of all, how this dark sign of the God image appears in a dream. And then how evil tries to propagate itself. And how we really can use the book of Job as a model to accept the experience consciously, but not take responsibility for it. In the dream, there's this intermediary reaction between the dreamer and his experience of evil, some way of either denying it or falsely taking responsibility for it, and then that is how this stuff propagates on. So really, finally, it is a matter of choice how to respond to this experience, and if we do respond correctly, it is possible not to be infected by it and to, so to say, stop the buck here and keep it from repeating itself. But otherwise, the tendency of victims is always to become the next perpetrator. And this is how to help a victim recognize the victimization, suffer it consciously, not take responsibility, and stop the train of passing it on to the next generation.
And also giving up being wounded. You know, one of the things about the 12-step program of the alcoholic is they all, you know, I am an alcoholic, and I said, so they never move beyond it. It never constitutes a new life with a new self-definition. And that sounds kind of like if he ingested the self-definition and he may be limping with it rather than creating a new self-definition.
Well, folks, that's answering Job. Questions, thoughts?
I have a question.
Yeah.
I just kept thinking about that statement about, you know, one has to drink the dregs of whatever has happened in order to take it in, and I just...
No, not drink the dregs.
But there is a statement that, you know, makes somewhere about that one does have to drink the dregs of what has transpired.
In this text?
No. I don't know. I was just thinking, you know, should he have drunk of that to become totally conscious?
No, I think you should have taken it and poured it out.
It's the act of taking it.
It's the act of taking it, which says, I acknowledge I have been abused, but I'm not going to drink it, meaning I'm not responsible for having been abused. And I won't continue it on. But ironically, and this I think is one of the great ironies, it is saying, I deserved it. It sets the stage for passing it on. Either saying, it didn't happen, or I deserved it. It sets the stage. It is saying, it did happen, and I don't deserve it. That is the way to overcoming becoming another perpetrator. And that's right. Right. So here the importance of the rage in acknowledging this is an awful thing. And then the therapeutic job, helping that person live with that rage. Not reduce, oh, you feel this way because your dad or mom, you see, you kill them. They need that rage. And then helping them maintain their innocence until we can have the unconscious respond creatively and find the way through it. And when the way is found through it, I think that then I don't think the rage ever goes away completely, but it certainly does mitigate it.
It becomes a slow, steady heat of the alchemical transition.
It can become a slow, steady heat, yeah. I know it's tough material, but I hope you can feel its importance, and thank you for your intention.
Thank you.